The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, your conscience of psychiatry. My guest today is Professor and Dr. Fred Ernst. He's a professor of psychology and anthropology at the University of Texas, Pan American in Texas. Now, Fred is a kind, caring, thoughtful, scientifically oriented individual. He's a real professional. One of the things that he brought up when we were talking at an earlier date was that psychiatry and psychology in our profession was actually going downhill rather than improving over the years. Now, that can be a kind of shock to people because the folks have the idea that this is science. Psychology is science. Psychiatry is science. Therefore, 10 years from now, it should be better than it was. And 10 years ago, it should have been worse. But in fact, psychiatry is not driven by the scientific method. It's not driven by the scientific approach, and neither is psychology, except in very limited areas. In all the important human areas, psychiatry and psychology are not fundamentally scientific. Now, there's two reasons for this. One is that it's only partially a scientific endeavor. A great deal of what psychology and psychiatry are really about are things that are really value-oriented. The importance of empathy being central, the importance of caring, the importance of respect human beings have for one another, great regard for the liberty and autonomy of other people. These are values. They're basic, fundamental values, and to a great extent, they're the values that this country was founded on. So the whole idea ultimately of psychology and psychiatry goes back to that root word, psyche or spirit, and it has a lot to do with values. Now, given that, it would be possible to have a science that studied values, a science that studied the effects that human beings have upon each other and that their treatments have upon each other. But in psychiatry and psychology, once you get into the areas of medication and diagnosis, the roots of modern psychiatry, the biological model with diagnosis and the biological model with drugs, you automatically get into an area that is dominated by drug company influence and money in complete collaboration with what I call in my books the psychopharmaceutical complex, going all the way back to toxic psychiatry and right up through my latest book, Medication Madness, the psychopharmaceutical complex. And so all the research, virtually all, a few exceptions, done in the field eventually panders to the biological genetic model and to drugs so that you can't even trust the research. Now, often I'm able to ferret out from the research messages that weren't intended. Particularly right now, I'm doing a lot of research on the long-term brain-damaging effects that we find in every class of psychiatric drug. But it has to be pulled out of research that's pretending and faking to show something else. For example, the research might try to show that ADHD causes brain damage. But when we look at the study, it's the drugs that the children were put on. So one must approach the whole field of psychology and psychiatry with an understanding that it basically will improve as human progress improves. It will not improve on some objective scientific basis. And so with that introduction, I bring on Fred Ernst, who is, again, a professor of psychology and anthropology, University of Texas, Pan-American in Texas. Hello, Fred.
Good afternoon, Peter. How are you?
Well, I'm energized. I'm really eager to be getting into these issues with you.
You've energized a lot of people over your career, and I just wanted to add something. You remarked about what I call, too, sometimes a devolution of the mental health enterprise over the past 10 years. I think it's been going on longer than that. And, in fact, my conclusions were really drawn after reflecting on a 40-year career. And as amazing as it might seem, I mean, you would think in a discipline that is as well-founded as ours are, that if you reflected on 40 years, as you were suggesting, you would look at a lot of progress, breakthroughs, discoveries. But I looked at my first days as a master's level mental health professional, brand new psychologist, going off into the upper Midwest to help build some new mental health programs. You probably remember that was back in the days of the comprehensive mental health centers. And I reflected on those days, and I'm looking at today. I reflected back on those days shortly thereafter, where when I finished my PhD, I began training psychiatrists and family medicine doctors, and I thought about training today. And my conclusion was, really, things are worse. On my 40th anniversary as a mental health professional, I can say things are objectively, observably, decidedly worse today than ever before in my career.
I think that's a reality. Go ahead and tell us, outline for us how it's worse from your viewpoint.
Well, just a few simple examples. When I first, experience I had in, for example, training psychiatrists, I had the good fortune of working with Dr. Joseph Wolpe. As you probably know, a lot of people consider him father of behavior therapy, systematic desensitization, very interesting, very knowledgeable guy who made a big splash back in the 60s and 70s. And it was my contribution to the training of psychiatrists in the late 70s, early 80s, was to provide a very comprehensive course on behavior therapy strategies. And that was a weekly meeting of a few hours a week, and it extended through most of the year of the identified year of that particular training. As I reflect on those early days and compare it to the later days, my later days, the only time I was asked to contribute to the training of psychiatrists was to address issues of research methods, usually very brief. There was not a lot of attention paid to research methodology, and I cannot remember, it has been a long time since I was ever asked to contribute a course, if you will, on psychotherapy or behavior therapy. And what I think that reveals is the shift in the emphasis from training psychiatrists, as I think they were very special in those days, where they were experts in psychotherapy as well as psychopharmacology. Today, I think the answer is simply psychopharmacology, and that's the emphasis on in training. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that it's even being presented in a very scientific way.
Well, I'm with you 100% on what you're saying. You know, we used to joke in the old days that a psychiatrist was a Jewish doctor who couldn't stand blood. That you'd be this mensch, you know, this nice guy, and you'd go to medical school, and you just didn't decide you wanted to be a regular doctor.
You probably don't want to hear this story, but my first job in the mental health center had a psychiatrist as the medical director for that particular center who was a retired surgeon. So I kind of, nobody said this, but I kind of figured the guy probably was a little shaky with the scalpel.
Yes, well, hopefully he knew that.
Yes, well, actually, you know, I must say, he was actually quite good. He was very conservative about medication, even back then in the 70s.
Imagine anybody now being conservative about medication except for maybe six of us around the country. But let me pursue with the thought I wanted to evolve, and that is that in reality, the people who became psychiatrists in my era were usually people who didn't plan to, but they went to med school, they found they had personal problems, they went into counseling or psychotherapy or analysis, they got help, and they decided this is a really good, humane, caring thing. I want to be a therapist. So they learned this. That was not my route. I came in knowing I wanted to be a psychiatrist when I got to med school. I'd already been studying it in my own heart and mind for, you know, 5 or 6 years before I got there. But most people went in that direction. But that's not even where they're coming from anymore. The modern psychiatrist sees in medical school that here's a way, a profession where you can control people, objectify them, diagnose them, give them drugs, give them shock treatment, which is very prevalent in the medical centers. Every medical center practically has them. Give shock treatment and be a superior and controlling person. Lock people up involuntarily against their will and just be a kind of dominating, controlling figure. So I think we have moved from psychiatrists in the past being people who were working through their own internal conflicts and trying to grow and then thought it was a good idea to help other people. Now we have these more withdrawn, objectifying, distant kinds of manipulative people going in the profession. Is that too extreme?
No, I don't think it is. I think there are certainly exceptions to that. But unfortunately, I think we're even where the exceptions are. I guess I would characterize it as over those 40 years, I see those who are pursuing the profession as far more economically sophisticated, if I could put it that way. That is, they see the profession as a place to make a lot of money, and I've always felt, perhaps naively, that the physicians I would like to be around, the physicians I would like to have care for me, are ones who really are concerned about caring first and making a good living next. It's always been a real dilemma for me, even when I was a practicing psychologist in private practice, and I should say especially when I was in private practice. It's hard enough to reconcile that you are actually making money, income, off of people who are suffering. But I think it's even worse these days when you see the level of greed in some entities where people are getting rich off of people, off of human suffering. I have a real problem with that. I don't know that I will ever resolve that, Peter, as long as I'm drawing a breath.
Well, I think it is something that we struggle with, but my own sense of it for myself is that I earn a living helping people overcome suffering. So I'm more and more comfortable with that understanding.
That's mm-hmm.
And I think we do that. We help people overcome suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But psychiatrists today don't do that. Psychiatrists today, with the drugs and the shock treatment in the hospitals, systematically make people worse. We have to face this. We have study after study now about how long-term exposure to any of the psychiatric drug groups, whether it's the antipsychotics, the mood stabilizers, the stimulants, the benzos, the antidepressants, they make people worse. We have accumulating evidence that they cause brain damage. The diagnoses tend to disempower people instead of helping them feel they're stronger than they were. And now that they've had therapy, that they really can take on the world, they think instead, I'm bipolar, I have limits, I'm ADHD, I have limits. So I think that the profession now, more often than not, is literally making people worse in the long run.
Yes. And the worst part of that now, I mean, you recognize that, Peter, long before anyone else has. And yet now, it's very interesting because now within the last couple of years, you have the work of Whitaker and Irving Kirsch and Joanna Moncrief coming out, reinforcing everything you've been saying for years. And I think now it's getting to be, it's harder to dismiss now that there are this many people on board and that the kind of data, the kind of evidence that they're putting forth there's no question about this anymore. So you're absolutely correct. I mean, look at the data. People are worse off based on the treatment that is being prescribed in the name of helping them get better off. And I think what's even more unconscionable is that these data, these findings are available to all mental health professionals who would want to keep up with the field. But if you ask around, people are not aware of these. They're not aware of this research. And worse yet, they dismiss it as if it's just criticism that has no relevance to what it is that they do. But the truth is, it's it's, as you point out, it's worse than these medications not being effective. It's that these medications are what physicians call iatrogenic. They are doing more harm than they are good in the long run. And God only knows what we have done to the population with the numbers of generations now who have been on these destructive drugs that have caused these kinds of problems in society.
Yes, and we're hurting on the unborn children with exposure to these drugs in utero. We're hurting these children in terms of withdrawal reactions after they're born. We know this in regard to many of the drugs that this happens, the antipsychotic drugs, the SSRIs, the benzos, the stimulants. We know that that the infant's going to go through withdrawal after exposure to these drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, if the mother stays on the drugs after the children are born, we're going to have mothers who can't quite relate to their children as fully as they might during
Absolutely.
The critical early months and years of life. Because the first thing to go with any kind of impairment of the brain, any kind of exposure to a toxin, the first thing to go is empathy, caring, love, the fine-tuning, the highest stuff goes first.
Judgment. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I did get energized just thinking about talking with you today. Now, you've probably done research in the areas of the importance of these early years.
Well, you know, let me say this. I think I haven't done research that pertains directly to this, but we have done some research here at UTPA looking at the experience of childhood sexual abuse, which by anyone's definition is a traumatic experience that has been shown to have brain-altering effects, especially when occurring chronically and early in life. And I think what's really alarming, Peter, is we have found here, and we've only replicated what's been found in many universities, that 1 out of 4 women will report having been sexually abused before the age of 12. 1 out of 4. When I saw those statistics, I couldn't believe it. But it's been replicated enough now to suggest that this is a phenomenon that is very reliable, and I think accounts a lot. And it's just one of the sources of potential trauma that occurs, as you put it, in the early formative stages of life, where the programming and the architecture of the brain is developing in such a delicate way.
Yeah, I think that it's very, very important. And it speaks to the necessity of understanding later life problems, not in terms of you were born with a biochemical imbalance, for which there's no evidence for any psychiatric diagnosis, but rather that as you grow, you acquire harmful experiences, and they're inevitable in childhood. The nature of the dependency of children, the stresses on parents, it's inevitable that every child experiences stressors and some degree of trauma. And as you're pointing out, at least a quarter of women are going to be sexually abused, and it may be as high with men, but they just won't report it.
I think you're absolutely right.
They're not going to report it. So here we're giving drugs and shock treatment and re-traumatizing people with authoritarian therapies who have been exposed to abuse and stress in their childhoods.
Absolutely. And you have now, I think, a public, and by that I mean at least in this instance, parents who are so believing that the medical establishment would, of course, do only the right thing with their children, that they literally hand these kids over to professionals who do 5 and 10 minute diagnoses of, for example, ADHD, and have drugs prescribed that parents will not question because of their belief that this must be right. It is the authority figure who's making this decision. And in fact, it's the beginning of a nightmare for many of these children and for many of their parents.
Well, and there is some good news. I mean, you mentioned people who have clearly built on my work, Robert Whitaker. The people who have been doing the research, like Kirsch and Antonuzio, have been doing the research on how the drugs are not really effective, despite the claims have been building. You know, I'm really grateful to live long enough to see people building on that early research that I did.
Yes.
So I think there's a glimmer of hope in a positive direction in that there are more people aware, and you've mentioned that, but the profession itself is digging itself deeper and deeper into a hole.
I agree. And if I can speak for clinical psychology, I mean, I believe it's headed in the same direction. You know that right now clinical psychologists are fighting for prescriptive privileges. They've actually won them in a couple states, and I could not be any more objection to this by virtue of the fact that all it does is open up more monetary incentive to medicate even more of the population. And I think it's just a very dangerous idea, and I've expressed that to the American Psychological Association, either to which they sent me a form letter justifying their position.
Yeah, it is a tragedy. I was involved in the middle of that debate. I'm actually a member of the American Psychological Association by virtue of a vote of the board of directors of the American Psychological Association for my research contributions to the field, which is
Absolutely.
The only way a non-psychologist could become a member. But I dropped my membership eventually if it's trying so hard to get it. I have respect for the
Well, you're in good company. I did exactly the same thing. I've not been a member of it. It's become such a political entity on behalf of clinical practice per usual, without any innovation or understanding of research. There is no longer the scientist practitioner being espoused at the APA level as there used to be back in the day.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised now if the annual meetings, I haven't been to one recently, of the American Psychological Association now have these big pavilions for drug companies the way the psychiatric and medicalist groups.
I don't know that for a fact, Peter, but I would not be surprised either. They are huge, huge meetings. And
they clearly are not allowing, because it's been tested, they're not allowing even presentations critical of drugs at the present time, as far as I know, at least the kinds of presentations that people I know have tried to set up. So there's this very powerful control that money and power and authority has, and the money ultimately comes from the pharmaceutical industry, and the power and the authority comes from the medical cloak that's put over the handing out of these toxic substances, essentially.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, after reading your work, after reading Kirsch and Moncrief and Whitaker, if you really look at that objectively, I find it hard. I don't know. I'm not a political scientist, Peter. I don't know the exact definition of conspiracy. But if this isn't conspiratorial, what's going on right now, I find it hard to characterize it with a different term.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story that illustrates what it really is. A couple of decades ago, George Bush was given Halcyon as a sleeping pill on his trip to Japan in order to smooth out his sleep pattern going to Japan. And he got sick, and he vomited at a dinner on the premier of Japan.
Remember that, yes.
So it came out that Bush was doing this, taking this drug. So then the New York Times observed and asked the question, why would our president be given a drug, Halcyon, that was banned in Great Britain for causing paranoia and memory loss? Hardly what you want your president to have on a trip. So I wrote a letter to the New York Times and said, I can explain this to you. I have here a picture, which I sent them, of the president of the American Psychiatric Association taking a check. I think it was for $1.5 million. It was over $1 million. I think it was $1.5 million. Taking a check from Upjohn, the manufacturer of Halcyon, to use as the American Psychiatric Association saw fit. So in America, unlike Britain, where there wasn't an eye batted except mine, apparently, here it is on the front page. They're proud to be taking over $1 million from a drug company. So I wrote
that amazing.
And the Times published the letter. So then the medical director of the Psychiatric Association wrote a letter of rebuttal in which he said, this was published too, he said, Dr. Bregan doesn't understand. We have an ethical partnership with the drug companies. So there it is. Here, I've been saying all along, these people are in an unholy partnership, and now out comes, in defense of themselves against me in the New York Times, the statement, we have an ethical partnership. And they bragged for about a year about that partnership business, and I so loved it, and I so publicized it, that they eventually, I think, dropped the concept. But it's not a conspiracy even in the sense of something underground, although a big chunk of it is underground. A lot of it is an open partnership that they're proud of.
It is amazing. I absolutely agree. It is, yeah, it is a visible conspiracy, and the American public certainly is too numb to recognize it as such, or too hyped with all of the stuff that you see on these incredibly clever advertisements that you see in commercials on television by the drug companies. Of course, there again, Americans are the only ones who are allowed to be victimized by these encouragements, for example, to get Abilify. Imagine, have you seen that commercial for Abilify? You know, as if an antidepressant, and they admit, by the way, in that commercial, that two out of three times someone is not responding to the antidepressant, so add Abilify, an antipsychotic medication. And people are just buying that. And, of course, they're going to their doctors and saying, gee, you know, my antidepressant isn't working as well as it should. Maybe I need this Abilify. It's really just amazing how blatant and above board most of it is. I agree with you.
And the power, just to remind my listeners, the power, the money involved here, Seroquel and Abilify are antipsychotic drugs, but they rank at the very top of income revenue of all drugs in the world. They're right at the
amazing.
Top.
Absolutely and it's the, amazing.
Yeah, and that's a measurement by revenue because they're very expensive. If you measure by the number of people taking Abilify and Seroquel, they're in the top 10 or so. I don't remember exactly where they are, but they're way up there. But when it comes to money, they're right at the top. Now the antidepressants are a little cheaper. They've been out longer. There's a lot of generics. And they rank number two in the numbers of prescriptions in the world. And the drug that's the top is Lipitor. There's lots of issues around that as well, but it's the anti-cholesterol drug. So we're talking about huge incomes, and we're talking about such power that you can take a drug intended for a fraction of the population, antipsychotics, a fraction, maybe 1% of the population ever gets psychotic, a fraction of the population, and you turn it into a drug that a big chunk of children and adults are taking. It's just catastrophically evil.
It is. It's frightening. It's even horrific.
Yeah.
And I just hope, though, that something's happening here now. I think there's enough people who have the kind of intellect and scholarly power that you have that are out there doing the trumpeting about what really is going on and how really unfounded all of this psychopharmacology is.
Do you run into personal conflicts and issues that you don't need to talk about them, but I mean, do you run into them as a psychologist? Of course, I've been subjected to every threat that pretty much you can imagine.
I've often wondered about you, I mean, because you've been doing this, and you talk about courage, Peter. I don't know. There aren't many. I can count on two fingers, maybe three, the number of people who have gone as far out on the limb for truth as you have. Thomas Zass is, of course, another one. I think your approach to the whole problem, though, has been far more comprehensive than his. And, you know, David Healy, you know the trouble he ran into when he began showing what the data really reveal.
And all he was talking about is one little area, which is the antidepressants, because Healy's a biological psychiatrist. Now,
he's
written a book, Pro-Shock Treatment. He's really a biological psychiatrist. But then he speaks out on one area, on the dangers of suicide from the SSRIs, and they stop him from having a professorship in Canada.
Amazing story. Yes.
Yeah.
But again, you know, there aren't many people who would have that courage, but I think things are happening. I think things are taking off. And, you know, I often wonder, too, and I'll just throw this out here. I think sometimes academicians like ourselves will go to conferences and we'll complain and we'll present the data and we'll talk about how what a bad thing this is. But you know what? We really don't have the power. I hope this isn't too naive, but I think the Elliot Spitzers and the really activist sorts of attorneys need to get more involved. When class action suits go on the behalf of injured parties, these pharmaceutical companies pay these things off with their pocket change, Peter. What I think needs to be done is I think attorneys can change the world. Attorneys can have an effect on this. And perhaps what it's going to take is every single person, one by one, who has been harmed by these drugs, every one of them needs to be a separate lawsuit until they get run dry for the kind of atrocities, really, that they have perpetrated on the American public. And I don't know if that's too extreme or not.
Well, I think it's a very good assessment. There's some indications that some of the manufacturers of antidepressants are starting to back off of future research, as they call it. It's really promotion of these drugs. Because they are getting really slammed, I don't know if it's true, but they're saying that. They're trying to gain some sympathy.
Yes, I saw I forget which company it was, but the best they could say was that they were going to disengage from the animal-level research. And that animal-level research is really problematic anyhow, and it doesn't really advance their cause, at least at animal-level psychopharmacological research. I'm not sure how big
one of my blogs on Huffington Post describes some of these drug companies and their advocates saying, hey, we're gonna just stop researching human beings and we're gonna stop advancing science, meaning we're gonna stop trying to promote drugs. I don't know if that's ever gonna happen. You will be happy to hear, Fred, I don't want to get into details, but I am working with attorneys on potential kinds of class actions that might dramatically affect some of the worst abuses and misuses of psychiatric drugs. So there will be
some new things occurring. Great. That's the best news I've heard in a long time, because really this is what it has appeared to me, even from reading Marcia Engel, is that how she pronounces
yes.
her? What she's had to say, I mean, it really, it's like it barely has an impact on these companies. They are so wealthy, and their profit margins exceed even that of the oil industry, which is just, I mean, unreal.
It's amazing, yes. Oh, and their profit margins can be much larger. Again, for my listeners, Marcia Engel, I guess it's really spelled A-N-G-E-L, isn't it?
E-L-L,
E-L-L.
I believe.
She
yeah.
is a physician and formerly one of the editors of the New England Journal of Medicine, and she's written books critical of how the New England Journal of Medicine, supposedly the premier American journal, has been manipulated by the drug companies. So she's come out and begun to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. And she has now, too, a book from just a couple years ago, I think it was, on the truth about drug companies.
Yes.
I remember, because it's not a very subtle title. It's like the truth about drug companies, how they deceive you, and what you need to do about it. I mean, it's real straightforward. But she is also, I understand, the former chancellor of Harvard University. So this woman has really incredible credentials. And her attack on the pharmaceutical industry, I guess, has been relentless. And interestingly, I believe it was a New York Times book review, she reviewed Whitaker and I think Moncrief, and it was just scathing with respect to the psychopharmaceutical industry and psychiatry and the APA. And when the APA responded to her reviews, it was so feeble, Peter. I couldn't believe it. I thought, they couldn't get one intellectual here to give more than one paragraph. And it was basically to say, well, we're neuroscientists and we're doing the leading, you know, the cutting edge stuff here. And one day this is all going to pay off. And, you know, and it's this big promise. And by the way, I think neuroscientists are as misled, if you will, as often as the practice of psychiatry is because of this investment in the neurotransmitter systems as explaining all of psychopathology, which is utter nonsense, as you and I both know it.
Well, they are very dependent for their research money on the drug companies, and in fact, there are research buildings on medical school and university campuses that are literally paid for and named after drug companies.
Yep.
So we're talking about a real hand-in-glove relationship yep. between drug companies and so-called neuroscience. Neuroscience in itself, of course, is, as I'm sure you'll agree with me, is totally legitimate. If you want to study
oh, absolutely. There's
the
no
function
question about it.
Of neurotransmitters and the and all of that, that's fine. But they can't get money for that. The money
yep.
they get is to falsely try to connect a very undeveloped science to explaining the mind, which
yes.
just we're just nowhere near anything like that. And that's where
I
it becomes
absolutely
fake.
Agree. Yeah, and, you know, if I could add to that, Peter, I mean, my impatience with that whole neuroscience enterprise is, again, the fixation on the neurotransmitter systems, when, in fact, you and I both know it is experience that changes what's between people's ears. But it's not just the neurotransmitter systems. It's this complex architecture of the brain that is altered by virtue of people's bad or good experiences. And your emphasis, for example, on caring and empathy is, to me, an exclamation point on the power of certain experiences improving brain function. I think that's what happens in the caring and compassionate relationship that you see in this very intimate process that we call psychotherapy.
Well, there's no doubt about it. We're linked to our brains, and our brains are going to be able to focus better. We're going to be able to focus better if we're happier, if we're more empathic, if we're more caring. In fact, one of the things we see with these very objectified psychiatrists is how bad their reasoning is.
Yes.
I mean, they start with a false premise. You have a biochemical imbalance. They then give you a drug which doesn't address any known biochemical imbalance but causes biochemical
yes.
imbalances.
And, absolutely.
And one step after another, the reasoning is flawed and controlled
it's
by the goal of drugs.
And it's at a philosophical level as well. I'm sure you've heard this phrase before, too. Gene-environment interactions. Peter, I have never seen a gene interact with the environment, ever, and I don't think you have either. People have genes that are manipulative. My genes turn on and off if I walk across the room right now. But to suggest that we are our brains or we are whatever our genes have programmed for us is a very misleading concept that I think is another fallacy promoted by the biological model.
Yep. Yes, totally, totally. Well, it's really interesting to talk with you, Fred. I didn't know what direction we would go in. I knew you had a lot to talk about and say, but I think that this hour is really about the psychopharmaceutical complex. And
it sure is.
I'd like to go back and remind people what that is. In the early 1990s, in Toxic Psychiatry, a book of mine which is still read and still influences, especially has influenced a lot of professionals to change their whole viewpoints.
Everything that's happening today is influenced by what you had to say in Toxic Psychiatry.
Yes.
You were way ahead of the curve.
Thank you, Fred. And by the way, I was so pleased, and then I want to come back and describe the psychopharmaceutical complex, but I was so pleased that that book, decades before we knew each other, had an influence on your career and your outlook.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Even before that, and when I first saw your remarks being made in a documentary called Madness in Medicine, back in the late 70s, and as I think I may have mentioned before, and I certainly have mentioned to students, we could take the quote that you made in that video and present it as a 2011 quote, and it would be very contemporary. It would be very relevant to what's going on today, and I think that reveals how far ahead of the curve you were, and still are, I might add.
Thank you, Fred. Again, we're listening to, of course, Peter Breggin, your conscience of psychiatry, and Fred Ernst, E-R-N-S-T, professor of psychology and anthropology at the University of Texas, Pan-American in Texas. Fred, we still have some time to go, but can you give contact information to people, and then I want to describe the psychopharmaceutical complex.
Okay, I would say probably my email address is the easiest one. It's FERNST at UTPA.edu.
Now say it one more time and give something to indicate what these letters
okay,
are.
Okay, that's F as in Fred, E, Edward, R, Robert, N, Nancy, S, Sam, T, Tom, at UTPA.edu, and that UTPA is University of Texas Pan-American.
Now, probably since you don't have Ginger Breggin in your life as I do, you may not have a big page up on the Internet.
No, I don't, but if she's responsible for that, I'm very impressed, Peter.
Oh, she's responsible for empathictherapy.com.org. She's responsible for toxicpsychiatry.com. She's responsible for my professional page.
I've only spoken with her briefly, and she is an absolute delight. You're a very lucky man.
I am a very lucky man, and the world is lucky to the extent that I've been able to keep going all these years and to do what I do, and so much of it in the last
Absolutely.
25 years we've been together has so much to do with her. But
well,
let me go briefly. Let me go briefly to the psychopharmaceutical
sure.
complex.
Mm-hmm.
The fundamental core of the psychopharmaceutical complex is drug company money, billions and billions of dollars. And that money gets spent and affects various activities, most directly the medical profession, where all the journals, almost all the medical journals, certainly all the well-known ones, are supported by drug company money. All the conferences are supported by drug company money. At the American Psychiatric Association, there are fellows and other people running around in the building supported by the drug companies. Then the research and the research buildings and even the research professorships at the medical schools are supported by drug company money. So you have an interaction that goes on between the drug companies, the medical associations of all kinds, the medical schools, the teaching centers, the research that is all inextricably intertwined with the drug companies. Then you go to the government, and you have the government agencies like the National Institute of Mental Health, where right in the middle of the big attack on Prozac years ago, the assistant director of NIH, the head of research at NIMH, he went right from the federal government to work for Eli Lilly. So you have this revolving door, I can name other names, between the federal agencies and, again, the drug companies. Then you have supposed parent groups that are supposed to be grassroots, but they're astroturf supported by the drug companies, like NAMI, which is supposed to be families on behalf of usually disturbed, very disturbed offspring who are now growing up often. Well, they again represent the drug company viewpoint. They get a lot of money from the drug companies. CHAD, which is supposed to represent the children with ADHD, drug company money again directing their activities. Then you have the insurance companies, which feel, I think wrongly, that it's much cheaper for them to have people going and getting drugs than getting psychotherapy. They haven't calculated in yet all the hospitalizations, all the damage done to people that cost the society so much money that's caused by the drugs. They just see it cheaper than psychotherapy, they think. So you have the insurance companies weighing in on this. You've got the academic communities, like the psychology communities, which have been bought because the psychologists, the social workers, they want referrals from the medical establishment. They want to, even in the case of the psychologists, to get prescription privileges. So you've got this huge complex, which I've only in a couple of seconds here begun to outline for you, that brings its full weight on promoting one viewpoint and attacking and excluding all other viewpoints. It's a very, very controlled situation in which it is almost impossible to find the truth in anything that's really associated with this entire health pharmaceutical establishment, the psychopharmaceutical complex. Fred, any further thoughts on that? We got a few minutes to go.
Just in a minute, I would only add to that is that, sadly, they are extraordinarily effective. Their marketing is brilliant, Peter. It is diabolically brilliant in my estimation. And the way they have manipulated research findings, what scientists call cherry picking studies to support not only the efficacy of their drugs, but to support their proposals to FDA for approval of those drugs, many of them were done with what we call cherry picking. In other words, finding the studies that support and excluding the studies that did not support the efficacy of the drugs.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred Ernst. This is Dr. Peter Breggin. You've been listening to us talk about the psychopharmaceutical complex that rules much of your life.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.